Kansas City, Missouri's director of Parks and Rec is retiring from that post after 44 years with the department. And when I say he built the city's parks, I'm not being poetic. He started out mowing grass and plowing snow, and then he moved on to building fiberglass playgrounds and chopping logs for log cabins. He also built golf courses and fountains, so he's leaving the department as a guy in a suit calling the shots, but he definitely got his hands dirty along the way. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're starting today's show by looking back on almost a half century of Kansas City parks with Mark McHenry. Mark, hi.
Good morning.
Take me back to those early days when you were mowing grass and plowing snow. What do you think you learned about this city by seeing it from that vantage point?
Well, first off, you definitely see it from our employees' perspective, because we have employees that are mowing grass today and have been doing it for well over 100 years. And part of the park system, of course, is the boulevard system. And that's where you either spread some salt or obviously plow some snow when the wintertime months come around. So learning it firsthand is important. And so you have a higher level of appreciation for those men and women that are out there either late nights or hot days doing the jobs that make the city the better place to live.
When you were doing those jobs, did you have a vision of yourself where you are now, or were you a person doing a job and just seeing where it would lead?
Well, probably a little bit of both. When I first started, a gentleman by the name of Frank Vadik was the director, and he was kind of a bigger-in-life kind of guy. So I obviously admired what he was able to do with the city, and I might have had a little vision of that. But for the most part, just doing my job and, you know, trying to, you know, earn a living and learn the park business.
What year was this?
Well, it all started in 1974. I went to school in Texas, and then I moved up here in the spring of 74 and started to work. And I actually worked out of a location just about a mile north of where we are today, over at 39th and Gillam. And that's where I started my first position with the city, and that's where I started the maintenance.
So can you take me to like a day on the job in 1974, working really on the ground for the city's parks and boulevards? Like, tell me about a memory you have or a typical day.
Well, I will tell you a good example. And I was a position called a management trainee, which simply means you're a kid with a little college education, but basically you worked as a crew leader. And so you were obviously in a position where you could work with the staff that had been around for quite a while. And you were working with men and women that were, in some cases, probably twice your age and kind of learning it from the ground up. But I will give you a memory. I really enjoyed mowing grass. And one of my favorite places to mow was the mall at the Nelson Gallery. And that grass grows pretty profusely along that line. It's a nice green area south of the Nelson. And So when I went a little break from kind of let your mind clear a little bit, I would take a big tractor out and mow that lawn. And, of course, that's a nice piece of green space. And so mowing is a kind of a relaxing thing to do, but it's also a worthwhile thing to do as well.
You know, I'm curious about the big changes that you've seen in the green spaces of Kansas City and how we relate to them since that time.
Well, it's happened in a lot of ways. We have a relatively large system. Obviously, the tradition of this system got started back at the turn of the century under the leadership of the Park Board and George Kessler, who is one of the well-known landscape architects throughout the country. And we've continued over those years to add parks, add green space, add boulevards, add parkways, add fountains. And right now our system, of course, goes north of the river. Back in the early days, the city didn't exist before 57, so we added a lot of land in the Northland, and there's still land to be added in the Northland. And then, of course, the fountains we're known for. We're 48 fountains right now throughout the city, and we've added several over the years. And we've also had to maintain a lot of fountains, too. Fountains not only have to look beautiful, but they have to be in good operating condition. So it's just a lot of additional facilities. Community centers have been added over that period of time. A lot of outdoor recreation facilities have been added. All of those in order to accommodate the needs of our community.
You know, it is funny. I guess the fountains in Kansas City really have this feeling of timelessness about them. And when I think about that, you know, you've been on the job since 1974 and you've been involved in adding a number of fountains, I guess it is sort of surprising to think of our fountains as being that new.
Well, in some of them date back. We do have a fountain that goes back. The Women's Leadership Fountain on the Paseo does go back to the turn of the century. So we're a fountain that's over 100 years old. But In the last several years, we have added some fountains. We've added a couple in the Northland, the Children's Fountain and the beautiful fountain up in Gorman Park. I mean, most of those have all been through private fundraising efforts. So the tax dollars did not go into them initially. Now we're maintaining them with our resources, but private fundraising. And most of them have a theme associated with them. We have a fountain that was built to honor those that had perished in the Vietnam War over on Broadway. So that's the theme associated with that. And obviously you may have seen just recently we redid them what they call the Myers Circle Fountain or the Seahorse Fountain, and that's one of the most iconic. And there again, that's been there since the turn of the century, but it took a little TLC and the private fundraising made that happen. The Nichols Fountain, which is right off the plaza, another one of those iconic fountains, had seen its better days, so it got a facelift and got renovated. So it's not only build them, but you have to take care of them.
I noticed that you were very careful to let us know just the limits of how where taxpayer money was and wasn't being used. Is that a growing concern in your line of work?
Well, it is. And, you know, taxpayer dollars are precious dollars. And, of course, it takes a sales tax, in our case, a half-cent sales tax to run our system. But when you add a lot of the things in the community, it gets not only gives the private sector an opportunity to contribute, but also gives them an opportunity to be part of what you're doing. And that happens in a lot of it. We do a lot of partnerships. Where they combine, the public dollars with the private dollars. And sometimes the projects are done with other governmental dollars. For example, state money or federal money goes into these. So, and with the fountains, I might add, too, that a lot of the private fundraising is established endowments. So not only do the funds come available to build some of these features, but also there's money set aside for the perpetual care and maintenance.
You know, we've talked a bit about the big changes that you've noticed just broadly speaking, has anything stayed remarkably the same about Kansas City's parks and boulevards and how people relate to them in the 44 years you've been involved?
Well, probably a lot of things. I mean, open space is gorgeous in this city. And, getting outside and enjoying the outdoors is probably no different now than it was in the years past. You know, a nice sunny day in the park or a walk in the park is not really changed all that much. And so we appreciate that. Trees, obviously, we maintain trees in the open space. But, as far as maintenance is concerned, and with other maybe a little shifts in technology, you mow grass today like you did 40-some years ago. And, picking up litter and things of that nature hasn't really changed drastically in association with that. A lot of technology has entered the picture as far as, how you keep track of information and record data and do your research. But a lot of things, it's simply a labor-intensive kind of position with our employees. It's a service industry all the way around. And so I think in some ways it hasn't changed all that much, but in a lot of ways it has.
Tell me about building fiberglass playground equipment. I did not realize until just now that that's a bit of a tongue twister.
Well, the location is called Penguin Park. It's up in the Northland. It's actually Lakewood Greenway is the park area. It's on Vivian Road in North Norton. A gentleman by the name of Vernon Jones, who worked for us back in the day, thought he would build playground equipment that wasn't the typical swing sets and slides that you would see in most playgrounds.
But yeah, this definitely is not that.
No, it's not. But some of the early features actually had some slides in them. But in essence, it was a wood frame, 2x4 frame, and then you'd build fiberglass shell around it. And fiberglass, you're familiar with, is a fiber product which requires, a matte material, but it's also got a chemical additive to it to make it a rigid structure. And the penguin, which is the highlight of that, is actually had a slide inside of it. And then there was a giraffe and there was a elephant. So it's not only a playground equipment, but also it's an icon. And of course, it's
This is a landmark. But what was it like to be part of that project? What was your specific role and what did
Well, part of it was learning how to do it. Well, there is a skill associated with that. So when you build this feature, when it's all said and done, it looks like what it's supposed to look like. Also, the chemicals you used were pretty intense. You had to wear a mask in order to keep from breathing all the fumes all the time. I do remember that. And it was just a hands craft kind of a project. And so obviously I had the opportunity to be part of that. And even today, you can go by there here 40-some years later and see some of those same features.
And you can't say that about a lot of playground equipment, honestly.
Well, you can't. And playground has changed a lot. I mean, a big part of playgrounds today, there's a lot of innovation coming through the playground industry. But safety is an issue. I remember the days when you played on a playground, you were on asphalt.
Yeah.
That was a surface. Today, there's a lot of different surfaces that are softer material. Kids tend to fall on soft surfaces. It seems like we grew up falling on asphalt and seemed to survive it over the years, but obviously safety is a big part.
Skinned knees every weekend.
Right.
Do you also built log cabins?
Yes. Shoal Creek Living History Museum, which is up in the Northland in Hodge Park, is a recreation of an old Missouri village. And what they were doing to build buildings back in the early, you know, about the 1850, 1860 time frame is they made them out of logs. So we would pick up an old log cabin somewhere in rural Clay County and bring it to the park. And about half the logs we could reuse, but we had to replace logs. So we actually had to go out with, you know, a broad axe and chisels and chop the logs and put them together and sort of rebuild the building. So those buildings are up there today. And that was done back in the 70s. And there again, it's kind of the way the life would have been in the 1800s in rural Clay County.
I was going to say, there are probably not many people walking this earth who are like, yeah, I built a log cabin.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's not something you do every day. And they're pretty neat the way they build them, a lot of logs. And then, of course, obviously, you've got to put a roof on them. And they have fireplaces in them to heat them and cool them. So you really appreciated the way that people lived, you know, back, you know, in that case, 160-some years ago. And the lifestyle. And, of course, we build them as authentic as we could with stone foundations and log and literally build them by hand. And we had a good crew working on that and you kind of learned it from the ground up.
There is this whole golf course phase in your career that intrigues me. I didn't think of golf courses before reading your sort of farewell. You have a farewell posted on the Parks and Recreation's website as well as one in the Kansas City Star. I didn't think of golf courses as being a huge part of our park system.
Well, today we have 5 golf courses. Throughout the park system. When I was early on in my career, I worked up at a place called Hodge Park Golf Course. The one that's adjacent to it now is the Shoal Creek Golf Course. But Hodge is the one we built back in the 70s. And building a golf course is, I mean, you're clearing trees and you're creating fairways and you're growing grass and you're doing golf course greens. Greens are probably the most challenging part because you have to make sure it has good drainage so the turf will grow. And it's a combination of hand labor and a lot of equipment utilization to make that happen. So we built the Hodge Park Golf Course. Hodge Park is named after Dr. Robert Hodge, who was former president of the park board. And that was our first golf course north of the river. And then we do have 3 golf courses south of the river. And irrigation is part of a golf course as well. And there's interesting. Of course, it's today is a big part of our system. We provide those opportunities for individuals to play on our 5 city courses.
When you... You know, the work that I do is invisible. I don't walk around the city and see evidence of my own craft. You know what I mean? Not in the way that I'm guessing that you do. When you walk around Kansas City or drive around Kansas City or just hear about where events may be taking place, does it feel, in addition to like the map of the city, that there's also a map of your life?
Well, yeah, because you can travel the city. And as I mentioned, we have a 12,000-acre park system. And we have a lot of boulevards, and you can travel, and you can pretty much point at things as you travel around, and you can look at it. And so there's physical evidence in most cases. You know, there's a lot of monuments that we've done over the years in addition to the fountains. We've obviously added parkland. You can go north up to the area. You can look at a water park that we built off of North Congress, for example. You can look at a water park that we built south off of Longview Road, for example. And, of course, more recently, we can look at the soccer village in Swope Park that was built here recently, the Urban Youth Academy, in conjunction with the mayor, James, and his office over on the Paseo at Truman Road. And you can see kids playing in both of those locations, whether it's soccer or baseball. And so you take a lot of pride in looking at those particular improvements.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that those kids playing, that was once just like words on pieces of paper and, you know.
Yeah, it was. I mean, any project, and that's, you know, there's multiple phases for any project. First, you have to conceive the project. And then you kind of put the partnership together, who all is going to be involved. You got to identify the funding. In most cases, in almost all cases, it's been a combination of public and private funds. And then you work through the architectural design process, and what you see on paper, all of a sudden, the contractors get started, and it starts to take shape, and you can step back and look at it and see if it looks like what you conceived in the first place. And then you can take a lot of pride in knowing it took place.
When the TV show Parks and Recreation came on, was that like a big deal to you, just that people maybe started thinking of what happened in behind the scenes to make their parks possible?
Well, it did. I actually, our national association, when it first aired several years ago, it was kind of like a watch party almost. You'd come in, let's just watch the first episode, because quite frankly, you couldn't believe they would actually make a TV show out of what we do. And obviously, it did pretty well. I mean, it stayed in the air for several years. And
how true to life is it?
Very true to life. Yeah, you can't make that stuff up. It's like real stuff. And it's, you get a big kick out of that in relationship to what they would talk about it. And you can see some of the trials and tribulations that they face, and those are the same things that, we deal with. And there again, it's a fun show to watch.
You know, is there something that you understand maybe about the city and our built environment, having seen what you've seen and done the work you've done, that a lot of Kansas Cityans might not fully grasp?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, parks provide all those great amenities, and it makes for a great quality of life. And, you know, we all think about the basics of city service, and obviously we have to have good roads to drive on, and we have to good, you know, water to drink and things of that nature. But all these other things, that open space, the recreation facilities, whether it's the community centers or whether it's all the great trails, or it's a basketball court or a tennis court or a volleyball court or you name it, those are throughout our city. And that's where we spend our weekends. That's where we spend our family time. That's where we go to picnics. And then we may go to the zoo. We maybe go in the National War I Museum. We may go into Starlight Theater. And the list goes on. And that's where we spend our leisure time and our family time. And I think it's important that people appreciate that. And I think they take it for granted sometimes. But just visualize this city without what we have to offer in the park system. And we think it's, well, we believe, and we know it is actually, that it's a critical part of living in a great quality city.
Do you have a favorite park or a favorite spot to visit in a park, or just like a location that's especially sentimental to you?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I think about some of the great parks that we have throughout the city, and Penn Valley Park is kind of special to me in a lot of ways, just because of the National War I Museum being there. And I've spent a lot of time in that park kind of growing up. It was one of the parks that I used to help maintain back in the early years, and take a lot of pride in the National War I Museum, the Liberty Memorial, and Penn Valley Park is a neat place. And remember a few nights that I'd stayed up late when my daughter was born at St. Mary's Hospital, right down the mall from the National War I Museum.
You stayed up some nights wandering in that park?
Yes.
Well, Mark McHenry, I hope you get to spend a lot more time there now that you're retired. Or will be.
Right.
Mark McHenry is the outgoing director of Parks and Recreation for Kansas City, Missouri. He's been with the department for 44 years. Up next, a local look at the report issued by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now you have probably heard about the recent report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the one predicting that some of the most devastating effects of climate change could be in effect as soon as 2040. So we're not talking about a distant future. For most of us, we are talking about stuff that is probably going to happen in our lifetime. When people talk about climate change in American cities, they usually talk about coastal cities ending up underwater. But what will climate change look like here in the Midwest? We're going to find out now, and later we're going to talk about efforts to stop these things from happening, or maybe just to adapt in case we can't. My first guest is Elaine Giesel. She's with us from the Kansas chapter of the Sierra Club. She's the conservation chair. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, glad to be here.
What would you name as the major concerns regarding climate change for our region specifically?
Within the urban community, particularly flooding and what we call the urban heat island effect, which is going to have real personal impacts on the citizens of our community.
How much flooding are we talking about?
What do we have? 10 inches of rain 5 days ago? Flooding on a major scale. We have seen flooding, and I listened to Dave Helling talk about flooding the other day, and he said, you know, it's been worse. We had the whole downtown flooded. What we're seeing is the flooding moving out more towards the burbs as we expand outward, develop outward, and create more impervious surfaces, roadways, rooftops, parking lots. Those floods tend to be hitting now more along Indian Creek, our area in Johnson County, where I'm from. Flooding happened in France today. Flooding is happening globally more regularly because the rains are coming perhaps not as frequently, but more heavily.
So why would it be a possibility, like when you're talking about impervious surfaces, if we changed our road surfaces, if we dug up the sidewalks and built new ones, does that change things or no?
We certainly hope so, because in a recent workshop on green infrastructure, that was one of our main foci, is that we have to find ways to reduce impervious surfaces, whether it's in new development by creating new standards that developers have to follow, or if it's by retrofit, by going back to remove parking lots that were mandated by local ordinances, say, you know, cars per acre or whatever. We have to get back to having surfaces where water can infiltrate and not push water off of surfaces as rapidly as possible. It's a whole new way of thinking. We call it transformational change. Don't move the water out, hold the water in.
This may sound just ridiculously ignorant, but it is a little strange to think about this combination of concerns of water shortages, which, you know, you hear about, especially in Kansas, the Ogallala Aquifer drying up. And then in the same breath to also hear about unprecedented flooding.
Right. And that is really the premise of this transformational thinking, is that quit thinking of water as the enemy, thinking of it as a resource, finding ways to capture, store, reuse.
But how do those things happen together?
You mean the depletion of the Ogallala? Well, it has to do with our geography, that half of the state is in a desert and the other half gets abundant rainfall. So in our part, the eastern part of Kansas and in Missouri, we're much more concerned about water quality issues than we are water quantity issues. And that's really a result of geography. We see it in other states as well, in Nebraska and Texas and Oklahoma.
What are some of your concerns besides flooding?
Public health impacts, the flooding and loss of property, which impacts homeowners, taxpayers, everybody, as well as vector-borne diseases.
What are vector-borne diseases?
We anticipate seeing longer seasons with disease-bearing organisms like ticks and mosquitoes. And if you look at the big picture globally, mosquitoes are the most dangerous animal on the planet. More people die of diseases carried by mosquitoes than anybody else.
Yikes. Would you say that the particularities of our region when it comes to climate change have to do more with geography, or do you think there is culture and politics to address too when you think of regionally specific aspects of climate change?
I think there's a difference between our urban mentality as how we address climate change and the more rural communities. We have an ag-based system in Kansas in particular, where climate change is going to have particular impacts on the crops we grow, the water availability. In our cities, because of the heat island effect, the way that cities, concrete, and buildings store heat energy, we have some real challenges in terms of how the public, particularly the poor, particularly those who don't have access to resources that can ameliorate the impacts of heat on human bodies when it doesn't get below 80 degrees for many nights in a row. And I think we have a duty as human beings, as citizens, as leaders, to make sure that equity is an issue that is on the table here.
You mentioned that in rural communities, there is a concern in Kansas about what crops will be able to grow, for example. Can you get a little more specific?
There are certainly crops which require much less water. Corn right now is subsidized through a federal program to help produce ethanol, but corn is a very thirsty crop. And one of the reasons the Ogallala is declining as fast as it is because of the corn growing. We could switch to sorghum or milo is actually a low water crop. We can go back to dry wheat farming instead of irrigated corn. There are options available.
Is there support for those options?
Probably not as long as there are ethanol subsidies available.
Oh, okay. So we've talked about the urban-rural differences when it comes to Kansas. You have been working on trying to protect the environment, trying to get other people to take that concern seriously for a really long time. And I would like to know more about how you've seen the response to that changing. I mean, how long have you been sounding the alarm on this, would you say?
The Sierra Club has been pushing for changes in the way we look at fuel efficiency standards in automobiles, which is currently under attack, for 30, 40 years. We have technology now in the hybrids. Every car could be a hybrid, but they're not. I mean, we encourage our members to take personal responsibility by driving vehicles that are more fuel efficient, whether they're electric vehicles or hybrids or just high mileage standard engines. We ask them to live closer to work, to use other modes of transportation than private automobiles, to use distributive solar on their homes.
This report, do those small actions on the part of individuals, do you believe that that has the ability to change this?
I think it's the way we have to start. Individuals have to become committed and passionate about this in order to become advocates at the larger scale. You're correct. The report says what we have to do in the next 10 years up until 2030 is unprecedented, both in the scope and in the type of technologies we have to apply. It's going to take a complete change of mind. And unless we have passionate individuals willing to come on radio shows and talk about it, then we're not going to get anywhere. We have to change the political will in this nation. And then we do that through the polls in our country.
Have there been, would you say, in the time that you've been doing this before now, turning points in public opinion or general concern about climate change in the environment?
No, I can't say that I've seen any great turning points, to be quite honest. We have seen with this new administration a rolling back of measures that were implemented to help get us to the point of enacting more emission reductions of CO2, the Clean Power Plan being our key provision in the Paris Climate Accord. And that has been is in the process of being rolled back, and we're going to supposedly back out of the accord.
Would you say that this is a turning point? Does it?
Well, certainly. It certainly has been. I mean, we're looking also at reduction in the auto fuel efficiency standards. We're looking at opening up more lands to exploration for oil and gas. We're looking at rolling back of a rule that just asked us to measure the amount of methane coming out of fracked wells. I mean, these rollbacks are going in the opposite direction of where we need to be headed.
I'm going to bring in another guest. Tom Jacobs joins us from the Mid-America Regional Council. He's the Director of Environmental Programs. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning.
What would you add to what we've heard, looking specifically at the Kansas City Metro, and then I'll ask you to sort of pull back that lens and talk about the region, but start with the Kansas City Metro.
Well, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, we were designated by the White House and the Department of Energy as a climate action champion. And as part of that work, we convened 200 or 300 people to talk about what it is that we could do to be a more resilient community in the face of climate change. We don't know what's coming our way. There's a huge amount of uncertainty around that. And so we asked the questions, can we predict what our future might be within certain boundaries? And can we then figure out strategies that might help us get started?
Tell us what you kind of came to, starting with that first question. Can we predict within certain boundaries what's going to happen here?
It's really an interesting deal. There are global and national scale climate models, and increasingly in the world of climatology, there's growing sophistication in producing what are called downscaled models. So we might be able to predict what's going to happen on a global basis or for the whole country, but what does it mean for Kansas City? And so we produced, with the help of a climatologist from Iowa State University, a set of projected impacts in extreme weather for the Kansas City region, looking out to the years 2060 and 2100.
And of course, can you share some of those?
I'd be thrilled to. Thank you. And so these projections depend on, in large measure, how much greenhouse gas emissions we continue to produce. And if we were to not change our current emissions trajectory, in the year 2100, it'll get a lot hotter. So right now we have about one day per year over 105 degrees Fahrenheit on average. That number will jump to about 22 days per year. And so with that comes enormous changes for natural systems, for public health, for public safety, for agricultural productivity, all these different things that Elaine was talking about. On the other, there's sort of two buckets of change that we talked about. One has to do with temperature, and the second is precipitation. And so there's sort of two dialectical findings that we noted and that you called out, right? On the one hand, we're going to see more flooding, but on the other hand, we might see more drought. And so we'll have longer periods without rainfall, maybe in the middle of the summer, but we'll have a lot more extreme events that come our way. Our average annual precipitation might go from about 39 inches a year to close to 45 inches per year. We might see more extreme events like we saw last summer in Indian Creek. So,
yeah, I mean, so that's the Kansas City metro, and then pulling back the lens, looking at the Midwest as a region, is there anything you would add or just more of that in more places?
Yeah, I think those trends can will be consistent throughout the Midwest. There will be variability depending on where you find yourself in the Midwest, but I think the increase in extreme events and the variability in the weather will continue. And so the report that the IPCC just published says we need to keep climate change to 1.5 degrees Celsius. As temperatures increase above that, the impacts become exponentially more precipitous.
So when you talk about that the future you're just describing is if we do nothing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, how would you describe the emissions state here in our region as compared to other parts of the country?
Well, to change to a more positive note, the city of Kansas City, Missouri in 2008 published a climate protection plan. And in it, they set goals of reducing emissions from citywide operations by 30% by 2030. And they set a similar goal for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. And since that time, they've taken inventories of how much emissions have occurred, and they just completed their third one. And they found that in citywide operations, they've decreased emissions by 40%. And citywide, emissions have declined by 21%. So those are extraordinary findings, that some of the huge changes that have occurred. One, Kansas City Power and Light has invested in about 1,500 megawatts of wind. And so their portfolio of energy production is now about 50% carbon free, which is an extraordinary thing. 10 years ago, maybe it was 80% coal. And the other thing is there's been huge advances in terms of energy efficiency, especially in commercial buildings. The industry and the technology have changed profoundly in the last 10 years. And so people are investing heavily in making their buildings more efficient because it's good for the bottom line and it's good for the planet. And so whenever we can find things that line up where it's good for the community, it's good for the environment, it's good for making money or saving money, then that's a sweet spot to be in.
When you talk about like making a structure more efficient, how do people have to still behave differently within those structures maybe than what we're used to? Well, like our cultural norms need to change in some ways?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the first thing is my mom told me to turn off the lights when I left the room when I was growing up, right? And so we can turn off the lights in the wintertime. We can turn down the thermostat, turn it up in the summertime. There's simple things you can do. In terms of taking care of your house, most people have the opportunity to increase the energy efficiency in their house, whether it's by putting in more insulation or it's a good practice to do an energy audit of your house to figure out all the ways that your house might be leaking energy and to figure out ways to prevent that.
We think of climate change, I think, usually as something that affects land and sky and water, but it seems to me that it would also affect populations and where people live. Would you guess that we would see a population increase in the Midwest as people potentially flee coastal cities?
Well, it's interesting. I recall after Katrina, there were a lot of people that left the Gulf Coast, and some of those people found their way here, and some of those people stayed. Demographers vary in their predictions on that, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if there were substantial climate immigrants to Kansas City, because we aren't going to have the severity of impacts that some of the coastal places do.
So how do we prepare for that?
Oh, that's a tough question, right? So as we grow now, maybe in our current forecast, we believe that we'll grow to about 2.5 million people by, I don't know, 2050. And so there's a lot that we are doing now to prepare for that level of growth.
Like what?
Well, in terms of how we build roads and sewers and houses and just the way that the city grows and all of the infrastructure that's required and private investment and different kinds of development practices. So as you start to add to those numbers, there's just more of it, right? And so it's a good thing in terms of our economy, but in terms of thinking about how we build a community as we grow the number of people who live here, it's a lot more challenging, right?
I get super survivalist when I think about this, and maybe that's just because of fear. But I start thinking about things like, you know, being sure that I know people who can produce the things I need in my own community, because relying on someone who can like ship me something to fulfill a basic need in my life seems scary. And when you talk about the relationship between what's good for our economy and what's good for ourselves as a community facing the potentially devastating impact of climate change, is there like more of a nuanced relationship there than some of us might think?
One of the things that's been interesting in our work is we try and take stock of what are the good things happening now in our community. And it turns out there's tons of them. You just had Mark McHenry on, and he shared a long history of wonderful things that the Parks Department is doing. There's a huge amount of activity, for example, in the world of urban agriculture, where there are urban gardens all over the place. There are maybe 250,000 food insecure people in Kansas City. So as we plant gardens to deal with issues like food deserts, health, nutrition, it makes a difference. The Giving Grove, a relatively new nonprofit, has planted north of 160 orchards just in the last 3 years. And this will make a meaningful dent in improving nutrition for people in need.
And then helping us like deal with things when they get real?
Well, there's lots of pieces to it, right? We could be talking about health or transport or water or energy. There's so many different issues. And so we need to look at these things all together and think about how can we be as smart as possible, as strategic as possible, and looking for solutions that are cross-cutting, cross-sector, make a big difference. But at the same time, like Elaine was saying, we have to start small. There are things that all of us can do.
And Elaine, I can tell you want to jump in here.
Well, it struck me in listening to the previous guest talk about grass mowing is that this is another transformational change that needs to happen. It's wonderful that we have this history of having lots of grass to mow, but the reality is we can't eat it. It takes nutrients, it takes water, and it takes energy to mow. The zen of mowing has to be considered against the downsides of mowing.
So, unless you have one of those handheld mowers.
I have an electric mower, but I also have issues with that because it's only 50% that's not coming from coal now. I'd love to see it 100. But Tom has a wonderful big picture partial solution, and that's urban forestry. And I'm going to urge him to go there because of the multiple benefits. And here, Sierra Club and Tom Jacobs are absolutely on the same page. Let's get more trees because, and I'm going to give it to Tom.
May I, Gina?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's fantastic. Some years ago, we did an inventory of the urban forest in Kansas City, and we found that we have about 250 million trees. And we found that those trees are producing about $320 million a year of value, whether it's public health because we're reducing ground-level ozone and improving air quality, or because we're saving energy, or because we're sequestering carbon, or because we're improving water quality. But there's so many other benefits, right? Think about your favorite street to walk down, right? It's probably a tree-lined street. If you can walk down the street in a tree-lined street, it's going to be cooler. There's going to be more retail activity. It's going to be a more vibrant neighborhood because people are out. At the same time, we have these incredible challenges with water quality in this community. The city of Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, both had consent decrees with the EPA to address the issues.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot in the show about Brush Creek.
We sure did. So this issue of combined sewer overflows. Well, trees are part of the answer. And so are native landscapes and prairie restoration and wetland restoration and stream restoration. All of these things add up to an idea about how we protect and restore native ecosystems in ways that provide all of these multiple benefits.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we are going to get more into how we can prepare for climate change in the Midwest on a policy level and as individuals. Do you know of a local effort to do something about this? Do you have questions about what you can do? 816-235-2888 is the number to call, and Central Standard will continue in just a minute. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking with Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council and Elaine Giesel from the Kansas chapter of the Sierra Club about climate change in the Midwest and specifically the Kansas City area at 816-235-2888. We've just got a little while left, so call now if you want to get in on the conversation. You can also tweet your questions and ideas. We are at KCUR CST. We're going to get back to big projects, but I'm interested in, Elaine, what you would consider to be the first steps for individuals.
Usually the first step taken is recycling, because it's an opportunity many are already paying for, and it's at your curbside, and it's relatively convenient. Now, there's a lot of bad press right now about recycling, and I hope people kind of ride this one out until we find good solutions. Personal actions are important, and those that mean the most to you. If you're a gardener, go out and change the way you garden. If you're a shopper, shop differently. If you
shop
like
differently, how?
Don't buy as much is the bottom line. Consumerism drives a lot of the problems we have right now with bringing goods over from China and so on, and disposing of them. We have no way to get rid of this stuff effectively. So just quit buying as much. Reuse, share, exchange, wear it out, whatever it takes to do that. Reduce energy use, whether it's through turning off the lights, whether it's changing the way you drive, ride sharing, public transit. I mean, there are lots of ways to do that. And getting a programmable thermostat is one good way to start. So
when you talk about buying less, I think about a holiday season, which is coming up faster than we might realize. And I mean, I'm so behind that. I think that culturally, that's a little tricky. We all sort of, I think, wrestle with what is.
But I think the market has driven us away from cultural roots, too. I mean, what was once religious holidays have become now marketing fests. So I think we can give up the consumer end of it and still retain the principles involved.
With maybe like a conversation ahead of time with relatives or friends, because you don't want to be that person who's just showing up with less.
And even if you'd quit gift wrapping, I mean, they're small steps. We don't change our lives overnight. Take the small steps first.
What do you say about this, Tom?
Well, there's so many different things. I guess the main thing I'd suggest is just to step back and think about how you live, how you get to work, how you eat, and think and ask yourself the question, what can I do that would make a difference? And think about that in your house or in your kid's school or in your community or with the organizations that you're involved in. And there's so many opportunities across the spectrum of issues that together we really can make a big difference.
Right, and show your impact at the when you vote as well. I mean, you can support those candidates who share your ideals and goals.
You know, a couple of mindset questions as we think about that. On a personal level, how do you maintain the level of awareness that you have day in and day out without sinking into utter despair? Because I think there is quite a possibility that how scary this is to really think about can maybe, it could motivate people, but it could also just be like I can't deal with this for more than 5 minutes kind of issue.
Well, that's a fantastic question. It's one that I honestly wrestle with quite a lot. So when I read the IPCC report, I was
terrified.
I was terrified. But on the other hand, I thought, well, we have a lot of fantastic things going on, and so what we need to do is double down. And it's not that hard. It's harder to think at large system scales, and it's a lot easier to think about what do I do in my life. And so in my job, for example, I interact with a lot of different people, and in each different sphere of action, there's opportunities. So they're talking about tree planting or public transit. And so what we want to do is make a difference where we can, and then think about how we can scale up whenever possible.
Okay, I have another mindset question, but I want to take a couple of calls. So let's talk to Al in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Al.
Hey, good morning. Wow, this is like a vast subject, but here's my question. In the 70s, we knew this information. We didn't have all the science to back it up, but all of this was known in the 1970s. And so that was 50 years ago, and we're now getting to a point where it's in the in the political realm, and we basically lost 50 years of time, and we don't have another 50 years. So what kind of mechanism do you think is going to be most effective to get the political will behind this to narrow that differential? Because we really only have about 20 years at the most.
Or 10, it sounds like. Elaine, jump in, because this is sort of what I was getting at with you before. You've been on this personally, you have, for so long. That must be frustrating.
It is frustrating, but we do retain the right to vote. We have a participatory democracy. And actually, I work with League of Women Voters as well, who have concerns about these kinds of issues. And we think the constituents should talk to the people they have elected and try to sway them in their positions. And we think that going to the polls and voicing opinions with vote is important. That's the only real way to change political will. Other than trying to change the laws that get dark money out of elections so that we don't have the fossil fuel industry, big pharma, the chemical industries having more influence over elected officials than the public does.
As people are researching candidates and wanting to know sort of their record on the environment and their likelihood of taking the kind of action that would stem climate change or increase our ability to adapt to climate change, what are some of the things, how would you recommend doing that research?
There are organizations that endorse candidates, and Sierra Club is one of them. We're not just a charitable not-for-profit. They can go to the Sierra Club website. Nationally has our national candidates are evaluated and endorsed, and we have state candidates, local candidates at our local websites.
Let's talk to Saeed, who is calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Saeed.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. How about you?
I am doing great. I'm glad we're having this discussion on the radio today.
What do you want to know or want to share?
So I am a plant-based chef here in the Kansas City area, and I wanted to know if we were going to talk about our diet or our food habits, our eating habits, and then how do we tell people? I know it's a hard topic, but how do we go about that,
well,
including it with climate change and how we can help in that way? Because I know it's big.
Let's go ahead and jump in and let Elaine tackle this.
Well, the only subject that is more sensitive than the food you put in your mouth is how many children you should have. And I'm not going to go down that road. But I will talk about food, because the Sierra Club has a very strong new policy on food and agriculture. We don't tell people not to eat meat. We do encourage people to eat locally grown, organic, pasture-fed meats, not industrial ag-based meats. But we encourage people to switch over to less meat, no meat, if they can do that. Small steps, as Tom mentioned, is one meatless meal a week. Start there on Meatless Monday and gradually build up a new list of recipes that are meatless. So food is definitely part of it. I think some have suggested as much as a third of the CO2 emissions are related in one way or the other to our agricultural practices in this country.
You know, and this is hard in our region because, as you've said, like, agriculture is a big part of Kansas.
Absolutely. But we have farmers markets. We need more of these urban gardens. We need to grow more in our backyards. We need to buy seasonal food. Don't buy stuff being flown in from Chile. I mean, there are ways to adjust your buying habits, looking at labels, looking at, as I said, seasonal, eating less in some cases of meat.
But then do we have to also have a bigger conversation about our economy in Kansas?
Not necessarily, because we see a large growth in organically produced materials in our farmers market that bring good prices and support farmers. So it's a question of what you want to be doing and where your markets are, though.
Tom, anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's true. The literature is solid on this point. Eating lower on the food chain is good for the climate and good for your health.
So that's that.
We're a barbecue town, and I'm not averse to indulging from time to time either. So it's always a balance, but being mindful of what you eat and where it comes from is a good thing.
One thing you didn't get to say yet today, each of you, that you want to leave people with. Tom, I'll start with you.
Oh, gosh. Plant a tree.
Absolutely. Go out and hug a tree.
Hug it. My son does that. Our time is up. Elaine Giesel, Tom Jacobs, thanks so much. And Elaine joined us from the Sierra Club, where she's director of conservation for the Kansas chapter, and Tom is the director of environmental programs for the Mid-America Regional Council. You can revisit our conversation about climate change in the Midwest at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we are getting ready for a giant beekeepers conference in our area. Did you know that? And how local farmers are dealing with all this rain at harvest time on Central Standard tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.